everyone.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for coming. My name is Ellen Flaherty, and I co-direct the centers here with Dr. Steve Bartels. And so I'm really happy you're here today to really talk about something that is really a pressing issue for many, many older adults. And I'd really like for the presentation today to be as informal as possible. So please jump in, raise your hand, let's have a discussion about this. And I hope that at the end of this that you all feel like you're one step further to staying in your own home. So the focus of this presentation is to really think about risks. So what are the risks that really contribute to folks who can no longer stay in their own home? And how do you move forward to mitigate those risks? How do we reduce those risks? I have to say, this is probably one of the most important messages for today. And I think the fact that you are all here, obviously you are thinking about this, and you are thinking about what are some of the things that you could potentially do to plan for staying in your own home. So what are folks' concerns about staying in their own home? What are some of the things that you're thinking about?
Being lonely.
Okay, being lonely. I think that we are faced in this rural community, and some of you are more rural than others, that is a huge concern. It's a huge concern for us, certainly, as providers. And when we think about what we need to do in terms of communities and what are some of the things that communities can do, that is one of the things that we think about, is how do we be in touch with people who are alone and what are some of those things that they are facing psychologically. So that is a huge concern. What other things?
Transportation.
Transportation. If we were doing that, Family Feud, where we could go ding and come up with like one of the top things, that's right up there. And so what happens, as you know, is that very often it comes a point in time where folks can't drive anymore. And one of the things actually that we have done in practice. And I'm on the primary care geriatric team, on the blue team across the street as well, is we've actually done some calculations of hiring car service and working with a car service to actually provide transportation. So when we have those discussions about somebody who can't drive anymore, of course the biggest concern is, what am I going to do if I can't drive? So when we actually look at what it costs to have a car, which is not cheap, as you know, and what are the costs of car services, and how often would you need to get where, and what is that cost? So that is a great concern. And some people actually, in their planning, really think a lot about that, right? So we have an amazing bus service, Advanced Transit. One of the biggest challenges, as you know, is that it's not on the weekends. And only goes to certain places and certain routes, but people move to live on the bus line. Mm-hmm. So at least they can have that transportation Monday through Friday. What are some of the other concerns?
Safety.
And we're gonna talk a lot about that. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Falls, going up and down stairs.
Trips. So when we think about planning, right, we think about how do you make your home safer, right? What are some of the things that you could be doing now, even if you don't have an issue with falls? What are some of those things that could happen in terms of doing an assessment of your home and identifying where these risks are, and again, mitigating some of these risks at this point? Are there grab bars in the bathroom? Those types of things. Falls are a huge concern, and I'm going to talk a lot about falls in a little bit. What else besides?
To get outside help. So if you are staying in your house to stay there forever, but get extra help for daily things.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a spouse, you help each other.
Right.
But if that spouse cannot do it anymore, isn't
mm-hmm.
here anymore,
mm-hmm.
then what do you do?
Right, and tell me specifically what your concern is about outside help.
Just with the household, with daily tasks.
Right.
Helping you maybe get dressed. I
right.
don't know if that is an issue.
Right.
Cooking, shopping for you.
Right. So I think it's a huge concern, and again, a huge concern.
Almost like living health.
In rural communities,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So in urban environments, right, even up in Burlington, you know, where there's, you know, high-rise buildings, and while there are some high-rise buildings here, it's very, very challenging, number one, to get the type of help that you may or may not need. So, for example, some people may need help getting up in the morning, getting dressed, getting breakfast, but then they're okay throughout the rest of the day, but then maybe need some help at night,
mm-hmm.
right? Getting into bed, maybe getting a meal. So what does that involve? How do you get somebody to come to the house twice a day? How do you, you know, should you be paying for somebody for 10 hours a day, right? So the challenges of getting help is, number one, finding people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's really two ways to do that. So it's private, so finding somebody privately, and hopefully then moving forward and doing background checks and, you know, doing kind of your due diligence, which is easy enough to do. And then there's hiring people through an agency, right? So the pros and cons to that are, certainly when you hire somebody privately on your own, it's usually much cheaper to do that. And in terms of, again, evaluating somebody or doing those kind of background checks, you can do that just as well as any agency can do it. In fact, you probably will do a better job than most agencies. Hiring through an agency is more expensive. However, you always have backup. So if you're somebody that if somebody didn't show up, you would be in real trouble, or you could not stay in the house without somebody there, then you really should do at least part agency, because then they will send a backup should somebody get sick or whatever the issue is. So most people who have significant help or need significant help to stay in their home usually have both. They have some private and then they have some agency help as well. But you're absolutely right. It is a challenge and it is very, very expensive. So again, you know, few people can actually afford to have, say, 24-hour help at home. Now, we'll get into this in a minute. The other issue is long-term care is very, very expensive too. So you have kind of two options, and what does that look like? Unfortunately, when people exhaust their resources, usually one of their only options is to go to a nursing home when they need significant amount of care, and then Medicaid pays for that nursing home bed. But we're going to try to move away from that and not talk about that today. Somebody else had a hand up?
Regarding safety, safety from being vulnerable to scams, people asking you for money, friends asking you for money, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So that can happen at any site of care, right? So that you could be living in an assisted living and that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're seeing more and more attempts. We actually run some programs here about that. We have worked closely with the local police about that. And so a couple of things. Number one, education is huge. Getting the message out there to avoid people from falling for a lot of these scams. And we see it, I hate to say it, but we hear about it on a very, very frequent basis about how people fall prey to a lot of scams. But again, I don't know that you're more vulnerable being at home. I think it's a huge concern as you age.
Yeah, you know, hand in hand with that, when you age, a lot of people develop dementia, and that's my concern. Someone who is mentally vulnerable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think that's also a great point. And as most of you know, you know, dementia is not a light switch that you flip on and flip off. It's not like a disease like even, you know, leukemia. It's a disease that starts out slow and gradually gets worse and worse. So there are most people who have mild cognitive impairment live at home. And as their cognition worsens, then there becomes issues for sure about them living at home alone. And we can also do things and mitigate risks for people who have cognitive impairment and are living at home alone. One of the biggest challenges is when folks start to wander. Mm-hmm. So when they start to wander outside of their house that and live alone, it becomes a huge problem. If they live with someone, then there's a lot of things that we can do in someone's home to prevent that from happening. There's alarms that can be put on doors and, you know, obviously bracelets and those types of things. So there is things that we can do when somebody lives with someone, but when somebody lives completely alone, it becomes more and more of a concern as somebody develops cognitive impairment. I think in general, the fear of developing cognitive impairment is huge as somebody ages. Mm-hmm. And again, part of that and some of the programs that we run here help to reduce those risks. So reducing risks for cognitive impairment actually are very, very similar to some of the things that we recommend for healthy aging, right? So it's exercise, eating right, reducing alcohol use, all those things that we talk about in general also contribute to reducing your risk for developing dementia, which again is an absolute huge concern. And using your mind, right? So there is some evidence about brain exercises. Mm-hmm. So there was a huge study, it was actually called the Nun Study, and it was done actually with Catholic nuns. And the study was designed to have the nun participants because of the consistency of their lifestyle, right? So they didn't, you know, they didn't have people who, again, they weren't married. Most of them never had children. They, you know, for the most part, didn't smoke. They didn't, you know, they drank, you know, minimally. And so they followed these nuns over a period of time, and they looked at those who developed cognitive impairment and those who didn't, and tried to identify what were some of the reasons for that. And one of the things they found was that the nuns who didn't develop cognitive impairment, or it happened later in life, were those that participated in, again, brain activities. So they did crossword puzzles, they were much more engaged in doing things with their brains, and that started, again, some of the research that's been done looking at that. Any other concerns that Jody?
How to build a support system when you don't have family.
Absolutely huge. We talked a little bit about loneliness, but that concern when there's not that, you know, network, or when there's not that the children or whoever it is that backup in the community. And we can talk a little bit about that too as well. Planning, how do you develop that network? What are some of the things that you can do to develop that safe network?
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of hiring people for various tasks, is there a standard evaluation checklist that could be provided for people who haven't any experience in hiring other people?
Absolutely, yeah. There are some checklists. I think, and how do you go about doing a background check for somebody? What are some of those things? You know, the other, of course, issue is references, right? So even if you're having a new bathroom put in or whatever, you don't necessarily do a background check on the contractor, although I guess some people do. But what, you know, getting references, and how do you move about that process to do that and really vet people?
And what personal questions are you prohibited from asking, and which information are you entitled to?
Right. So when you hire somebody privately, you can pretty much ask whatever it is that you want.
Including social security numbers?
So interesting question. I'm not an attorney. So I really, you know, don't know the legal implications of that. I think if you are going to pay someone Social Security, you need to have their Social Security number. Mm-hmm. Or if you are paying them privately, kind of, you know, under the table, then I think The other issue is when you do background checks, you often need a social security number to do that. And I just think that that's good practice to do that. And I think if you ask someone if you can do a background check and they say no, that would kind of raise the hair on the back of my neck. So again, very often that question can be used just to vet people in the first place.
Just a follow-up, in terms of references, people aren't going to give you the names of people who have not had a satisfactory experience with you if you're looking for employment with somebody. So reference is not necessarily a key to good practice.
100% correct, but they do help. And when you look at somebody's references, if they've worked for different people every 2 months, versus somebody who has worked for somebody for many, many years, and then, you know, asking them what the challenges were. I mean, I think you get a pretty good sense of somebody's job history for sure. You're right. Nobody's, and if you see, periods where they were not working, you would think they probably did work for somebody and it didn't work out. So again, you kind of, and we can certainly help with that as well and help somebody to evaluate.
If that's the sort of checklist I'm interested in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Isn't it the issue of trust as well? If you got a reference from a friend, wouldn't you trust that? A reference from a friend, I'd like someone to do, oh, I know so-and-so.
Oh.
I'm talking about trusting those.
Absolutely. So if it is a reference from somebody that you know, of course, but if it's a reference, I think you were referring to a reference for somebody that you didn't know.
Reference from the person you're proposing to hire.
Right, but that you would know,
yes,
the reference.
Right.
I think you're saying if you knew the reference, right, then they were your friend. That's the other thing. I mean, living in small communities, one of the things that we find is that, they say there's 6 degrees of separation. In the Upper Valley, I think there's like 3 degrees of separation. You always know somebody who knows somebody who, you know. I mean,
yeah,
it's the same way with employment. We were just talking about that yesterday. Is we can generally find something out about somebody who comes in for a job. Somebody knows somebody who knows somebody. And So it's one of the, I guess, advantages and disadvantages of living in a small community, for sure. So what are the greatest risks? I don't know why that thing is there, that recording thing, because it's, anyway. You have the slides, it's not so urgent. So I'm going to talk about three kind of buckets, or three kinds of categories, I think, that contribute to these risks. Certainly the physical health issues, and we talked about that. So what happens when you can't do stairs safely? What happens when there are other risks like falls? So very often what will happen is people age, they move. They move to different apartments. They move to different houses that can enable them to live on one level. People begin to think about that. Could I convert my dining room to a bedroom if I had to? Is there a bathroom here? What does that bathroom look like? Is there a way to do some improvements in the bathroom now that might make it easier? So is there potentially a stall shower? If I have a new shower put in, can I have one put in that doesn't have a lip on it that I could actually maybe go in a wheelchair? What do the doors look like? Would it be possible in terms of living somewhere if you had a wheelchair? So that decreased mobility certainly is a big concern. What kind of steps do we have outside? Is there something that we can do? Is there a side door that you could easily put a ramp that would make it easy? I'm going to talk a lot about falls because that is one of the biggest issues that actually the injuries sustained from falls are very often kind of that trigger or that event that leads somebody to not be able to live in their home anymore. So I'm going to talk a lot about that. We talked a little bit about dementia. Depression. I think that we talked a little bit about isolation and feeling isolated and feeling lonely. It's one thing to feel lonely, and it's another thing to have a clinical depression. So what we see with folks who have clinical depression is they certainly stop eating, or they reduce their intake. They have poor sleep. Depression is a risk for cognitive impairment, for dementia as well. So I think especially people who have a history of depression, thinking about that. So what are some of the things that we can do to reduce the risk of a recurrent depression? Getting involved, coming out to programs, forcing yourself to be more involved with people. There are things. Speaking with your provider. Do you need to take an antidepressant medication, and how does that help? So that's extremely important. Financial issues. So we talked a little bit about what does that mean, in terms of paying for help. So even if you found the help, you have an agency, whatever it is, how do you begin to pay for help? And I think it's a huge issue. Some people, again, plan for this way ahead and have done financial planning. So they are comfortable and able to do that. I think working with certainly financial planners and attorneys are extremely important. And I highly recommend that folks actually meet with elder attorneys as they age, as they potentially need more help. And why would you meet? Has anybody here been to an elder attorney? So elder attorneys are specialists in elder law and really can help you to better understand entitlements, for example. So what happens when you run out of money? How do you, what can you keep and still apply for Medicaid, right? What are some of the other entitlement programs in your state that you might be able to tap into? The two states have very different resources and services. So in the state of New Hampshire, ServiceLink is the agency. They are the contracted funded agency from the state. So they sit in our area in the Lebanon Senior Center. So Jane Conklin, Allison Morgan are the people that are in this area for Lebanon. And we can obviously help and identify who that person is in your area. In Vermont, it's different. So Vermont actually has a very coordinated system through One Care Vermont. And that has SASH services, which, again, we can go into. But again, what are those services that are available to you? And is there things that you could potentially be doing now in terms of thinking about that? So if this is my income, these are my savings, how do I move forward to get some assistance? What does that look like? Do I meet the threshold for getting assistance at this point? What happens when I hire help, right? So if you, I'm just going to give you an example. So let's say the threshold for food stamps, as an example, is $300 a month. Let's just say your income has to be $300 a month or less. I'm just making that up. I don't really know what the number is. I'm just saying as an example. And your income was $2,000 a month. Well, if you spent $1,700 on hiring help or $1,700 for your medical care, your income then would be $300 a month. So even though you see things published to say, well, poverty level is X, you need to be making this in order to get food stamps, maybe somebody coming to your house to help out, potentially Medicaid to pay for some of your medical care as a supplement to Medicare. All those things are deducted from your total income to come with your net income. So again, it's helpful to think about some of those things. Some of the mistakes that people make are to transfer funds. to their family members, for example, in thinking that, you know, I've worked my whole life to have this home that is worth $150,000 that I own. I own that home right out. And that's really something that I want to leave to my children. So I really want to protect that asset. So I'm going to transfer that house into my son's name. And then the next week they have a stroke and they need a lot of help. Well, that transfer will prevent them from going on Medicaid. And it becomes huge, huge issues. So I highly recommend before you do anything in terms of gifting, whether it's gifting money, gifting a house, gifting anything, or transferring anything, that you meet with an elder attorney to make sure that you're doing it in the right way. There are ways to do some of this. You can do some of this in trust. So there are mechanisms that you can do. But again, I strongly recommend that you meet with an attorney before you do any of that. When we think about physical health issues, we talked a little bit about stairs, in and out. Personal care, what does that mean in terms of getting somebody to help out with laundry, to help out with meals? Meals on Wheels is available in this area, which is certainly an option. Meals on Wheels are provided by, in this area, through the Grafton County Senior Citizens Council. The meals come right out of Lebanon. The meals are delivered 5 days a week. It's a nominal charge. Most people that receive Meals on Wheels don't pay for them, because it's a service that's provided because of their income. So somebody comes between, you know, 11:30 and noon every day, they bring you a meal, and then on Friday they bring you two meals for the weekend, bad lunches kind of thing. So that is certainly something that's available. I think we think about in terms of, you know, physical health issues, what other injuries that you would potentially prevent you, again, outside of falls, other types of, you know, fractures, other types of mobility issues that people have that, again, reduce their balance. I think one of the things that we get quite concerned about, certainly, is older adults who have physical mobility issues and they're cooking and potentially could sustain burns. And again, when we look at certainly safety in someone's home, we think about, again, their capacity to prepare a meal or to cook. Mental health issues, I've already talked a little bit about dementia. The other piece to this is when we talk about the elder attorney. If there is any cognitive impairment, that's certainly in the early stages, that's one of the most important things to do. Because you want to be sure, number one, that what you want is going to happen, right? Mm-hmm. So you can do that through a financial power of attorney, but also in terms of your healthcare wishes and what they are, and what do you have to do to set that up as well. So we talked about depression and then the money management, which obviously can become a huge concern. And one of the things that we, certainly in geriatrics, and when we screen people for cognitive impairment, one of the things that we ask people in terms of their function is, are you still doing your finances and are you, you know, paying the bills? We very often ask children, Is your parent, is your mom still able to manage her checkbook? Very often, what happens is that when people begin to develop some mild cognitive impairment, especially people, actually when you look at people and look at their intelligence, very often we find that people who have a much higher educational level and intelligence actually can fool people a lot more. So people who are very articulate, people who, for example, school teachers, very often can carry on conversations and have significant cognitive impairment. So they have conversations about the weather. They have conversations about, you know, they're able to, again, continue to be engaged. And if you had a conversation with them on the grocery line about the weather or living in New Hampshire or whatever, they would be absolutely able to carry on a conversation but wouldn't know what they had for lunch or couldn't tell you their address. Scary part of that is some of these people are still driving as well. But one of the first things that we see is people actually can't manage their finances. And again, there's some things that we can do. Actually, most of the banks in our area will manage somebody's finances for them and pay their bills. So there, again, are services if people are willing and if people are thinking about this and planning for it. And again, having a trusted friend or having someone that you that obviously you need to trust. I talked a little bit about the financing of private help. Assisted living facilities are extremely expensive. And I'll just give you an example. Certainly our local assisted living facilities like Wheelock Terrace and Valley Terrace, they range anywhere from, you know, $6,000 to $10,000 a month. And that, you know, obviously is just a very small percentage of the population that can actually afford to live in that environment. There are some other options. For example, Outreach House. Has anybody here ever been inside Outreach House? Do you know where that is? It's like, it's on
Park Street.
Park Street, yeah. Right across from the college, almost to the intersection of Wheelock. And it's a not-for-profit corporation that was actually endowed by a woman from Hanover. And I believe their capacity is for 8 residents there. It's a lovely, lovely home. And they have, you know, they have a cook, they have somebody who assists people with meals, they can assist you with bathing. I have had people that have actually had hospice and have died there. So they can actually accommodate people who need significant amounts of help as well, just like the assisted living facilities. And they're about $3,500 a month. It's a much more homey atmosphere. So, you know, the analogy I use, I'm like, well, if you like to go to a bed and breakfast, you'd like Outreach House. If you like to go to a Marriott, then maybe you'd like to go to Wheelock Terrace or Valley Terrace. That's kind of like, what do you like in life, a Marriott or a B&B? But what I find is that the care at Outreach House is just amazing. I mean, it's, again, very, very small. They have a lovely living room. They don't have, again, a lot of the, you know, activities, certainly that a lot of the assisted living facilities have in terms of, but they do have people coming in and running some programs. And then there are some assisted living facilities that actually do take Medicaid, but those are few and far between. Wheelock and Valley also have a couple of Medicaid beds. So that was kind of part of the deal when they were actually got the license to operate, that they had to provide some care for people on Medicaid. So that is an option, but for very, very few people. Nursing home care, as you know, is even more expensive. So nursing home care is about $10,000 a month. And I think many of us have experienced, have gone into some of the nursing homes in the area. I think it's quite challenging to live in a nursing home. And what we see happening is that more and more nursing homes are actually taking sicker and sicker people. So again, qualifying for a nursing home. Years ago, you know, when I first started, you know, 40 years ago in geriatric nursing, you would have nursing homes that would have like one unit that it was essentially people who, you know, decided that they didn't want to live alone anymore. But they were, I mean, some of them even drove cars. But now nursing homes are really exclusively for people who need significant amount of assistance. And again, unfortunately becomes the only option sometimes for some people. And I think, you know, we pretty much can have anybody live at home, regardless of how much help that you need. Okay. I have had people who live at home on ventilators, on respirators. I have had people at home with intravenous. I mean, we can really keep anybody at home. It has to do with, number one, planning, right? And thinking about that, and what does that take, and people's willingness to hire help. I have a lot of patients who have the resources and either A, don't think that they need the help, or B, just refuse to go down that route. And that, unfortunately, sometimes significantly increases their risk. And they wind up falling, breaking a hip, and winding up in a nursing home.
No, I was just wondering, do you meet with families to set this all up, or what is your function?
So I think it's extremely important to meet with, for an individual, mm-hmm. to have these conversations with their families. There are also private care managers. So for families who live at a distance, very often that's an option to hire a care manager who manages all of the things, manages all the help, manages that so somebody can stay in their own home. So sometimes if somebody is alone with children at a distance, they can do that. Otherwise, the children jump in and really function as the care coordinators and the care managers for an individual. But it's extremely important to do this in collaboration, certainly with your family. And we certainly can do that as well in terms of meeting with people and their families, which we do all the time.
And when you say we, who is we?
So at the Aging Resource Center, the services that we provide are, number one, direct one-to-one counseling for people. In terms of people who are developing dementia, we have a lot of support groups. And so we will meet with patients and their families to develop that plan, to say, it appears that you need this help. I'm gonna give you a list. These are the agencies in the area. These are the assisted living facilities in the area. So there are a number of us who do that. Certainly Rebecca and Chizuko. Rebecca is a dementia resource specialist. Chizuko is a resource specialist. We have Janie Childs, who's our chaplain, who runs a lot of our support groups. There's a fair amount of people around to meet with patients and families to develop plans. And usually, by the time somebody gets in to meet with us, they're experiencing something that is really requiring some kind of action plan, mm-hmm. as opposed to just kind of a planning visit. But we're absolutely willing and able to do that as well.
Are there private care managers in the Upper Valley?
Yes.
Examples?
So there are two, and their names are escaping me right now, but we have actually had their cards, I believe, at the desk who do that. There's actually also another thing that I just learned about that I'm really intrigued by. It's an organization that certifies senior move managers. So these individuals, from what I'm learning, just going on the website that certifies these people, they actually help people to downsize. They actually help people who are in the process of thinking about moving, or people who just want to reduce, like, the clutter. Think very often people are like, oh my God, my kids are just gonna have, like, what the heck are my kids gonna do with all this stuff? And so people who are interested in that, so they will actually come in, help you. They will get the dumpster. They will do, you know, and they actually physically can help you do some of that. And a lot of times they're hired as well by children when somebody wants, something happens and somebody has to go to an assisted living, somebody has to go to a nursing home, and here are the children with this house, like, oh my gosh, how do I even begin to get somebody to come in and, you know, assess what's really valuable, right? How do I get some of this stuff appraised, that there actually may be some valuable antiques or whatever? So these move managers can do all of that for somebody. So I think that there are people around.
The Resource Center itself has provided that downsizing program in the past, and maybe they still will.
Yes, they do, and I think it's in our brochure. Our fall brochure is there, and we have that. And we also are running a program that actually gets sold out immediately, it's free, on hoarding. So this is a program for professionals. So it's a 3-day training, and when this guy comes, I mean, he's amazing. This guy comes from Amherst. He kind of wrote the book about how to help people. We also run a public forum for that. Has anybody here been to it?
Yeah,
was it great?
Yes.
Yeah.
I've been to the one, the money, and you know, the title was "The Kids Don't Want It."
Yeah.
Which is true.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, you know, back to my first statement, this is all about planning, right? This is all about thinking about, I mean, a lot of people think about it, but actually taking the action to move forward and do it is a whole nother step. So when we think about falls, and this is a huge concern of ours, and many of you may or may not know that we run fall prevention programs here, and we run them in the community. So we run them at the Senior Center, we run them at Upper Valley Aquatic Center, we run them at CCBA, because this is such a huge issue, clearly because of the injuries, but also because this very often is a precipitating event for someone who needs to move to another level of care because of what happens with a fall. Falls can actually be caused by an acute illness. So when we see somebody in the office who comes in that they've had, say, maybe 2 falls, or that they've had a fall, even if they don't have an injury, we think about what contributed to that fall. So we have people that fall all the time, but then what happens when somebody comes in and they've had a couple of falls? Is the beginning of the presentation of something else. What we do find is that falls are actually happening because of another medical issue. Not that somebody's acutely ill, but actually somebody is fainting, right? So they are losing some consciousness, so they're having a low heart rate, or they have an electrolyte imbalance. And usually we find that in people who all of a sudden begin to lose their balance very quickly over a short period of time. So 30 to 40% of older adults who live at home fall, and more than half of people who live in nursing homes fall. Again, the annual incidence of falls is close to 60% among those with a history of falls. God bless you. The greatest risk for having a fall is that you've fallen before. So when we evaluate risk, we look at really 3 things. Did you fall more than once in a year? Did you have a fall with an injury? And do you think you have problems with balance or walking? So those are kind of the 3 general screening questions that have been developed to identify risk. Based on those 3 questions, 38% of people over the age of 65 screen positive with just those 3 questions. So it's a lot of people over the age of 65 who are at risk. We also run balance clinics here. So just because somebody screens positive doesn't necessarily mean that they are absolutely going to have another fall. So I'll give you an example. You know, we can have somebody who's, you know, 68 years old who runs a marathon kind of trips over a dog leash or something and breaks their wrist. Well, they would screen positive, but maybe they're not somebody that actually needs to go into an exercise class because they're, you know, very fit. So at the balance clinic, we do more testing. We actually do physical testing, physical balance testing, gait speed, get up and go, tests that we use to see, again, how strong is somebody or how weak is somebody, and how much is that weakness contributing to their falls. What we know is that if somebody can increase their muscle mass, that will absolutely reduce their risk of falls. Complications of falls are the leading cause of death from injury in older adults. When we think about the cause of falls, it's rarely just one thing. So what we think about is kind of this interaction of a number of things, right? So what chronic diseases does somebody have? So for example, very often people with diabetes develop what we call neuropathy, which has an impact on the sensation in their feet. That certainly contributes to falls. Some people have vertebral issues. So, you know, we think about like the inner ear and what does that do in terms of their balance. Some people have something called vertigo, which has to do with the crystals of their inner ear. And what we do know is that very often, if somebody just had one of these things, right, maybe they wouldn't fall. But as soon as you layer on one additional thing, then that really significantly increases their risk for falls. So I'll use alcohol as an example. So very often people will, you know, obviously a lot of people drink alcohol, and people will come in and say, well, I've had a drink every night for my entire adult life. I have one drink when I get home from work. I have a Manhattan, I have a martini. That's all I have. I've been doing that forever and I'm fine. But what we know is that when people age, the impact of the alcohol is much more significant. So what I say to people is that when you were 25, when you were 40 and you had a martini, it had an impact of X. Now, at your age, it's like you had three martinis when you were 40. Like, that's the impact of the alcohol. So if somebody, again, has maybe one risk factor for falls and then has a drink, that could significantly increase their risk of falls. So what we try to do is we try to peel away the onion, say, okay, and we do that in part at these balance clinics, let's think about what issues that we're dealing with here, right? Some of them we can change, some of them we can't. One of the things that we look at, for example, is multifocal lenses. Significantly increases people's risk for falls. Now, people have multifocal lenses for years and years and years, right? And they get used to them, right? And again, is that the only sole cause of a fall? No, but you add that onto X. I have some arthritis, so I have some pain, and sometimes my knee buckles, right? And then I have the multifocal lenses, and I have those slippers on that don't really have a very good grip, and I just had my floors waxed, right? So that's like the, you know, the perfect storm, right?
What's the last one? Yeah. I just had my what?
Floors waxed.
Oh,
right, yeah, yeah. I just had a patient, actually, who was on her running up her steps, stepped onto her hardwood floors in slippers, and just, like, fell. Lucky for her, she didn't injure herself. But again, it was a combination of things. It was these kind of socky slipper things that she had that didn't have grips on the bottom, and then the the slippery floor. Most falls that older adults have some injury. 10 to 15% of falls result in a fracture or a serious injury. So, risky, but 90%, right, 85 to 90% of people who fall don't sustain a serious injury. Again, the thing that we look about for any fall is how does that fall in and of itself increase your risk? Knowing that you fell once, fall twice, you fall more than twice, the more falls you have, the greater risk you have of falling again. What we see, again, is that there is actually a significance between mortality and falls. And some of that is that people who are sick for whatever else is wrong with them is actually really what's causing the mortality, and they fell because of that. So it's hard to say these falls are what caused the mortality. And very often the mortality is associated with surgical risk. So people who have, you know, fractures that have to be surgically repaired. What we see sometimes, again, in terms of injuries, is that after a fall, we see somebody has further functional decline because of some of those injuries. there's an increased use of medical services, whether it's an emergency room, a hospital, or a nursing home. Anybody in here have fear of falling? So we run a program called Matter of Balance. Has anybody done it or has been part of it? The focus of Matter of Balance is actually to reduce the fear of falling, right? We run other programs like Tai Chi, Moving for Better Balance, which physically helps you. We run other exercise programs. Matter of Balance is some exercise, but it's really focused on reducing the fear of falling, because the fear of falling is actually a risk factor for falling. And one of the things that we also look at after a fall is, could somebody get up on their own? Mm-hmm. Somebody who can't get up on their own, again, that's a much greater risk factor. When we hear of situations where people fall and can't get up and actually have what we call a long lie, mm-hmm. that is a huge predictor for bad things to happen, bad things to come. One of the things that we think about certainly are people using lifelines, what happens if somebody falls, what to do in your own home if you were to fall. So, talk a little bit about Elizabeth. Elizabeth has lived in her home for 45 years. Her house has changed over this time. Her children's room is now a sewing room. And after her husband passed away, his office was renovated to be a TV room. So what are some of the things that Elizabeth has done or is thinking about doing in terms of planning and putting measures into place? And she has, family is local, but her children work. And more importantly, she doesn't really want to be a burden to her children. Mm-hmm. However, she's thinking about planning. She's thinking about, what are some of the things that I need to put into place formally, right, with my family, with my caregivers, to think about what are some of the things to reduce the risk. So, either a lifeline, or that she is in communication with her children or someone every single day. So if she did an X show up, if something happened, somebody would know that if they don't get her on the phone, right? Two, grab bars. Already talked about that briefly. Grab bars are extremely helpful. Just to go back a little bit about falls. What we know about falls is that everybody trips, right? Trip on a whatever, you trip outside. And most of the time we recover from that trip. We don't fall. And why don't we fall is because we have a certain amount of strength, right, in our legs. There's something to grab onto. And so what we do in terms of the balance training is we work on strength, certainly to help people to recover from a trip. And then when you think about grab bars and where can we strategically place grab bars in people's homes to help that. No throw rugs. This is a toughie. People, they are just in love with those darn throw rugs. And yeah, but again, how do you either, how you're placing with them, place them. Sometimes a throw rug will actually move when you step on it. Can you put like one of those rubberized mats on there? Again, I can get you today, if you'd like, a whole assessment sheet, a home assessment sheet, that you can go around your home, and it will identify some of the things that you maybe should be thinking about in terms of risk. Medical providers close by. What happens when you have to get in to see somebody? What happens when you're maybe a little dizzy, maybe something's going on? We strongly recommend that people have local providers. We very often here at Dartmouth get calls from people in Rutland, people far away who want us to be their medical provider, but we strongly recommend that somebody have a local provider that they can communicate with. And there's a lot of things that are being done right now in primary care to think about how to better care for older adults and what are some of those systems that we put into place. So here on our geriatric team, for example, we have an entire community team. So we actually make home visits. So we have providers and we have nurses who actually go out and make home visits for people who can't get out of their homes and can't come into the office. We have care coordinators, we have care managers who actually contact people at least once a month and talk to them to come in ahead and begin to identify when something is not right. So again, has somebody been falling? Does somebody have more swelling of their ankles? Have they been dizzy? Did their care provider not show up? Those types of things that we call our triggers. So we have care coordinators who actively call people at home to identify if they have any of these triggers. We talked a little bit about regular meals being delivered. and families taking turns. What we often find is that, again, people don't want to burden their families. And this is something we talked a little bit before about having family meetings. Sometimes we actually function as the kind of coordinator with a family to say, this is what you guys need to do right now. You need to develop this plan to help mom stay at home. And what does that involve? Well, that involves somebody doing her grocery shopping. That's going to involve somebody driving her to her medical appointments. That's going to involve somebody cleaning, right? Or coordinating somebody to clean. Who's doing the laundry, right? So coordinating that with her family. What we often find is that there will be one person in the family, one child, for example, who kind of is willing to step in and take over. And very often what we find is that people get burnt out. And people get resentful, and then there become sibling issues, and somebody says, well, you know, I'm the daughter, but, you know, what the heck's my brother doing here, you know? And so we can kind of be the broker for that at times, which is helpful, to sit people down and to say, this person is really getting burnt out. And when this person gets burnt out, that's really going to have an impact on your mom's ability to stay at home. So let's come up with a plan. And I have to say, for the most part, most families figure it out. Again, sometimes we move, you know, sometimes there can be tremendous resentments and problems in families. But we really help to mitigate that. I think, again, back to that first slide about planning, right? You thinking right now ahead, right? And the family, and who are your supports? And what will that look like? And what are some of those conversations that you could have right now and thinking about that? So I think that that's extremely important.
I'd like to go back to the one medical provider close by.
Mm-hmm.
There are times in everyone's life when small events occur that can't be taken care of by the person to whom they happened. I cut my finger when I was peeling the onion, or I tripped and I didn't fall, but I banged against the table and now I'm bleeding. I think it's either my lack of knowledge or it exists, that there are not enough emergency care opportunities here in the Upper Valley. At one point, I had a bite that was getting red and ready to explode or whatever it was, an insect bite, or I'm not even sure that's what it was. And I called my provider, my ordinary primary person. Well, 3 weeks out, you can get an appointment. That didn't help. Somebody, a friend, again, this wonderful network here in the Upper Valley, said there's an urgent care place over in West Lebanon,
mm-hmm.
and I went there, the room was packed. Mm-hmm. I can't even let anybody look at that bite for another 5 hours. In the meantime, I could be dead.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying this not because you have the answer, but because somebody needs to address the question. And if you have connections with people who can deal with that, that I think is an urgent need in the Upper Valley.
So you are 100% correct. it's what we call access, right? So access is a huge, huge problem. So one thing I can announce to you right now is that we opened up an urgent care clinic across the street and the hospital. Yeah. So it just...
How come we don't know about it?
You don't know about it because we had a soft opening, right? So anybody who knows about developing a business, developing any program, you need to get the kinks out, right? So it's open, we're telling people, but there will be kind of a grand opening. But before you have a grand opening and start inviting people to come in a big way, you better get those darn kinks out. So that's what's happening right now. But they're open, open for business.
Where
so
is it?
It's right in 3M. So where primary care is at the hospital, it's open every evening from 5 to 8, and it's walk-in. Don't need an appointment. Just walk in. Right now, there's not huge waits because there's not very many patients. Again,
until tomorrow.
We're like, whoa, what happened? So, but that's not for everybody, right? So that's real. That's one thing that can be done, right? But you're right. Once the word gets out, you may go sit there for 2 hours, right? Mm-hmm. Emergency departments are just about the worst place to go, right? Mm-hmm. Just absolutely horrible. And we have a, you know, our emergency room across the street has a fast track, right? That they can do some of that. But even through the fast track, you could be there for a really long time. Primary care practices are really obligated to help to manage acute issues with patients. And certainly across the street, we have what we call triage nurses, right? So a nurse gets the phone call, and a nurse then says, okay, so you have a bite, right? Do you have a fever? Can you use your arm? Has it gotten bigger? Are you having any problems breathing? Like, is this something you're allergic to? No. How much does it hurt? Well, it's like a 3/5, you know, but when I touch it and it gets hot, well, then the nurse says, guess what? You don't need to be seen today, right? So we're going to triage this. Now, triaging it for 3 weeks, that bite is either going to kill you or it's going to be gone, right? So, like, that is really, you know, unacceptable. So it is really hard sometimes as a triage nurse, right, to determine who really needs to get in, who needs, we need to call 911, right? So that happens. And who needs to get in within the next 24 hours, who needs to get in by the end of the week, and then who can we schedule for 2 weeks from now? But it's challenging. It's really challenging to be able to do that because, as you well know, most patients, myself included, would like to be seen right then and there. Like, can I come in this afternoon, right? And it depends. Access goes up and down. So... again, we work on this, but it's really, really hard. And I think some practices are better at it than others. What we're doing on our team is we're developing something called, and I hate this word, teamlets, right? So it's a physician, what we call an associate provider, so either a nurse practitioner like myself or a physician assistant, a nurse and a medical assistant. So they work together on the team. Ultimately, it's, and I'm happy to be in a room with people who, when I say Marcus Welby, they know who that is, because most people that I work with, they don't even know what Marcus Welby is. And it's, to me, it's about that, like having that team, right, that Consuelo, you know Consuelo, and Consuelo knows you, that you can call up and talk to the medical assistant and say, you know what, Mary, I swear that Dr. Smith told me to take 2 water pills Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, but I can't remember now, or whatever that question is. And Mary says, hold on, Dr. Smith, did you want Mrs. Jones to take whatever? I mean, it's that team let. So how do you do that? Because what we find in this big system is, like, we have all these people in these teams, and we got the green team and the gold team and this provider and that provider. And I know, as a nurse practitioner, very often I would be seeing patient after patient after patient that I never saw before. And that's really challenging, obviously, primarily for the patient, right, to have to be seen by somebody new all the time. If you have an acute issue, you expect the chances of you getting in with your primary provider is much lower than somebody being available. But at least if it's somebody on that team or somebody you've seen before, that's much more helpful. And in a case that you really do need to get in, you don't care who you see at that point. You'll see anybody from any other team. But access is a huge issue, and something.
Mm-hmm. Can I just ask, what is the role of a community nurse?
Great question. So many of you have likely heard of, or maybe not, of a community health nurse, right? And there's a community health nursing initiative, the Upper Valley Community Nursing Project, it's called. It was developed by Lori Harding and Dennis McCullough. And the idea is to, for their role, is to work with communities to hire a nurse. So kind of a town nurse. Sometimes it's called a parish nurse. Now, many, many, many years ago, when I became a nurse, I worked as a visiting nurse, right? And I worked in a small community as a visiting nurse. And it was before all like the rules and regulations and insurance. And we literally, I mean, this was in a small town on Long Island, and the house where our office was, there a nurse had lived in that house for 100 years and had seen people in the community. Babies, did well baby checks, that kind of thing. And the idea was that we kind of, as nurses, as public health nurses, had our arms around this community. And we knew people in the community, and we knew who needed help, and we could be dispatched into the community. And we would, again, hopefully somebody had insurance, but if they didn't, there was a community fund for that. Well, we know that that no longer exists, unfortunately. So this is kind of an attempt to get back to that a little bit. How do you have a community nurse that is not reimbursed by insurance, that a town comes together to say, we want to support this community nurse, that can, right, have her arm or his arms around people in the community who are really frail, people who, and again, it's not necessarily for geriatric patients, but you know, 99% of what they do is really monitor what's happening with older adults who live at home. Now, these nurses do not provide hands-on care. They may take a blood pressure. They may, if they had to, change a dressing, but they're not visiting nurses. Many of you know, Medicare will pay for you to have a visiting nurse when you get home from the hospital, for example, and they can follow you for a couple of weeks, and that's reimbursed under Medicare. But that's a very short period of time, right? So once that is up, then what happens? And so if you're an older adult who's frail and really needs that ongoing monitoring, what happens? So again, these community nurses very often work part-time. We actually have a project, Dartmouth Hitchcock, is actually supporting a team out of the Lebanon Senior Center called the Light Team, which is the Lebanon Interdisciplinary Geriatric Healthcare Team. It's a nurse and a social worker and a community health worker that work together on a team. And we're in the process of evaluating and monitoring some of that to see, you know, can we make a case that the hospital, right? So we're not gonna get into talking about accountable care organizations, but an accountable care organization really should think about how they can achieve better outcomes, right, and reduce their costs, and while still providing excellent care. So for example, in an accountable care organization, you really want to reduce the use of the emergency room. You really want to reduce the use of hospitalizations, intensive care units. Those are huge, huge cost items, right? So maybe if we provided these community nurses who could identify triggers, or we could dispatch to somebody's home in the time of need, we could actually save a lot of money and provide much better care. So I think we're in the infancy stage of that. Right now, I believe that there are 8 community nurses in the Upper Valley. And again, most of those nurses work very part-time. I have to say, I think Lyme, New Hampshire, is probably the most sophisticated at this point. So they have had a community health team in Lyme for a really long period of time. They actually have a secretary, they have somebody answers the phone. And the other thing that when we think about okay, so you have the registered nurse, but there's a lot of things that have to happen with people that they identify that doesn't need a registered nurse. So let's say the nurse goes to the home and somebody doesn't have their water pill. They ran out. Well, right now, what is, and they don't have children, they don't have family. Well, the nurse is running to the pharmacy now to get the pills. They walk into a house, there's no food. The nurse obviously is gonna then go and get, so there are things that, activities that we really feel like a community health worker working with that nurse and being the eyes and ears for that nurse. You could have, again, two community health workers that would be the same cost as one registered nurse. So again, this is starting small, but we're thinking about this in a much bigger way, and even on a national level, and really focusing here, of course, on rural communities, right? So back to, you know, a high-rise building in Manhattan, or even, you know, the apartment buildings in, you know, Cathedral Square, which is where some of these programs developed up in Burlington. You can have a nurse sitting in the building who can, again, identify and manage, you know, hundreds of people who live there. Very hard to do in a rural area, right? So on our community practice, I mean, we can see 2, maybe 3 people in an afternoon. So blocking a whole afternoon, I could potentially see 8 patients in the office in an afternoon. I can see 2 at home because of the, you know, the geography and the distance, and, you know, maybe 3 depending upon where they are. So, you know, it's not necessarily a sustainable model. You really need to think about what other models are there and how do we go about doing that.
I'd like to suggest a PS that it not be restricted to geriatric concerns. Young mothers or young people who don't have family around.
And you're absolutely right. And it's not. It's not restricted to geriatrics.
Big need.
Right. We also have another initiative coming out of the emergency room using community health workers. And those are for people who wind up in the emergency room a lot, because they have nowhere else to go, and they are very often are people who are, when we think about, you know, social determinants of health. So these are people who don't necessarily have a lot of money. Very often there's substance use, there's unemployment. I mean, huge, huge social issues for people who just don't know what to do when they wind up in the emergency room. So we have community health workers helping them to, again, how do you go about getting insurance, having a primary care provider? These people don't even have primary care providers, so you're right. There are a lot of other issues in our community that are not necessarily geriatric. When we think about, back to talking about falls a little bit, one of the things, again, is weakness, and when we think about some of the programs that we have in the exercise programs, that's probably, if I were to advise people to do one thing as they age, it's exercise, and it's moving around. And not necessarily, it doesn't have to be exercising with a personal trainer. The research has shown that people who do even minimal amounts of exercise, and if anybody's come to some of the exercise programs we have here, we're not, you know, we have this guy here lifting the weights. Not that weight training is bad, but it's not exercise, again, like going to a personal trainer. Twice a week for 30 minutes. We have videos here of a program, and it's called Use It or Lose It. It was actually developed here by Lisa Fermansky, who's a physician who's now an APD, but was here at Hitchcock with her and Donna Pigeon, who runs our Balance Center. And these videos, we have them. I can get them for you. Really run through a short program of exercise. Again, what we know is that people who have regular exercise significantly reduce their risk for falls. Significantly reduce their risk.
We have that in our town in the senior center, Monday and Friday and Tuesday and Thursday classes. Mm-hmm. And they're 10, from 9 to 10. Usually they don't take a whole hour, but it's great. And I go whenever I can.
Yeah.
All the time.
We actually have a resource booklet that shows all the exercise programs in the Upper Valley and all the towns. And we restricted it to programs that were either free or a nominal charge, so some of them are $3 or $5 or whatever to join a class.
It's a dollar by us.
Yeah. And that's interesting. So the idea of charging a dollar, right, you say, well, what is that? But we actually, the studies show that when people pay for a class, that they actually take it more seriously, and that when they pay in advance, they come to the class. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things that we think about. We don't charge for any of our classes here, for better or worse. I don't know. The way we're going, maybe we will start charging for the classes. But at any rate, pain. Pain has a significant impact on people's lives in general. Upwards of more than half of older adults living in the community and three quarters of older adults living in facilities have some chronic pain. And pain can obviously have an impact on your gait. And this is just the FACES scale, one of the things that we use to assess pain in older adults. We also refer people to podiatrists, so people who have significant pain in their feet as well can increase their risk for falls. Medications. And I'd like to just spend a little bit of time on this. If we look at specific triggers that either lead people to the emergency room, the hospital, their doctor's offices, this is right up there, one of the top things. And so what is it about medication? Well, number one, it's the type of medication, right? So when we look at a medication list, right, certainly we have a falls clinic. So one of the first things that we do is we have the pharmacy look at the medication list. So there are some medications that are just bad for older people. And there's actually something called the Beers criteria, B-E-E-R-S. And the Beers criteria is identifying very specific medications that should never be prescribed to older adults. You can Google this, you can download the whole list. And what we find is that, as most of you know, medications are filtered in your body in a number of different ways. Sometimes medications are filtered through your kidneys. Sometimes medications are filtered through your liver, right? So we think about Tylenol. Tylenol is filtered through your liver. So there has been a lot of studies done that have said high doses of Tylenol is certainly not good for somebody's liver. And somebody who already has some cirrhosis maybe shouldn't really be taking Tylenol, right? There are other medications like certain antibiotics that are filtered through your kidneys and actually can cause kidney damage. So we look at how medications are filtered in your body. We look at how medications pass what we call the blood-brain barrier. So how do they get into your brain, right? We look at medications that have sedating effects, right? We look at medications that can cause things like palpitations, medications that can cause thinking disorders, right? Medications that alter your blood sugar. And so there are certain medications that right off we say, that is a high-risk medication. Blood thinners, right? Very often people take Coumadin. Because they've either, you know, had a stroke or they have an irregular heartbeat, atrial fibrillation. And that is a really risky medication that has to be monitored really, really closely. So there are these medications that, and I'm just going to go to the next slide here, which actually these are the medications that absolutely increase your risk for falls. So there's this group of medications that we say nobody should be taking these, right? Then there's another group of medications when we look at those risks and those medications to say, for example, an antidepressant, right? The antidepressants we use today are miracle drugs. many, many years ago, the antidepressants that we used had tremendous side effects and were terrible for old people. So it was, you know, your depression had to be pretty bad for you to consider the risks and those side effects of those medications. So the medications that we use today for depression have very, very little side effects. They're wonderful, wonderful drugs. However, they do increase your risk for falls. They can interact with other medications. So there's that other group of medications that actually are good medicines for you. It's good that you're taking those medicines, but they actually have risks associated with them. There's really not a medication out there that doesn't have some type of risk, right? But some of the risk is great. Some of the risk is really low. And again, it depends on how effective the medication is. Is it really treating what it is, what your problem is? Is it really helping you and improving your quality of life? Sometimes it's hard to know that, right? So antihypertensions, right? Anybody with high blood pressure, most people who have high blood pressure feel fine. They don't have symptoms. Yeah, some people can get headaches, but most people, that's why they call it the silent killer, because hypertension, people have it and they don't know it. Very often what happens is when we give somebody a medication, they feel worse sometimes on an antihypertension. It can be lowering their blood pressure too much, and that can cause problems as well. Other types of cardiac medications, again, can lower your heart rate, can speed up your heart rate. There's a class of medications called anticholinergic. And that's, a lot of these medications are on this Beers list. Some of those medications are used for urinary incontinence. It's a medication called Ditropan, which is a pretty popular medication. Any of the Sudafeds, right, any of the medications like that can cause dry mouth, right? So very often you'll feel it in terms of a dry mouth, but they also can increase your risk for falls, increase your heart rate, right? So some people, when they take Sudafed, they get that kind of, you know, little tachycardia, little racing of the heart. And again, that's generally a class of medications that it's not that we don't prescribe them, but we're really, really careful. So back to why are we talking about this today? When we think about risk, right, one of the most important things that I do when I think about risk, and I again, we talked about falls, we talked about financial planning. This is one of those things that I look at. What are the medications that somebody is taking? How are those medications potentially having an impact in general on their ability to grow old and be healthy? God bless you. How are these medications having an impact, again, on somebody's fall? So there are issues with medication. Then there's the issue with adherence to medication regimes, right? So when I say that, what I mean is that a lot of people decide what they want to take and what they don't want to take, and they will alter what it is that we advise them to take. And I think that's, you know, absolutely terrific, because I think nobody knows you better than yourself. However, it's important to have those conversations with providers who can say to you, you know what, let's cut it in half. Maybe if we cut it in half, right? But by stopping a medication, again, because maybe you're experiencing a side effect, your blood pressure may be going up, or there may be other things that are happening by stopping that medication. So what I try to do every time I see a patient is to get rid of medications. Get rid of the medications. DC the medications. Get rid of them, because of a lot of these reasons that we're talking about. However, to me, it's all about patients' choices and patients' decisions, but that has to be about patients understanding what the risks are, right? So it's my job, right? It's my job to tell you what the science says, right? So this medication is used for this, these are the side effects, and I'm recommending it to you because of X, right? Then that's your decision, right? Once I tell you what the risks and the benefits are, right? And we call that shared decision making, which is kind of the, you know, fancy word for actually having a conversation with a patient and educating them about what, you know, you're recommending. So, you know, I think what happens very often, I mean, not very often, it happens less often, is that actually people take each other's medications. I mean, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, I don't even need to go into the opioid use and the problem there. But I think the issue of how medications increase your risk, and we talked a little bit before about cognitive impairment and financial management. Well, cognitive impairment in terms of medication regimes is huge. And so when we're thinking about developing systems and supports in the community, is there a way for somebody who can respond to maybe an alarm to take their medicine, but the medicine can be set out for an entire week for them, right, in a pill box? I mean, I recommend most of my patients to have a pill box, because even people who are not cognitively impaired, people who are just really, really busy, are like, did I take my medicine this morning? I don't know. Did I take my noon medicine? Did I take this medicine? You have it in the pill box. It's easy to say whether you took it or whether you didn't take it. And it helps to organize, especially when you're taking more than one medication. Unfortunately, the average number of medications that older adults take, if we look at everybody 65 and over, it's about 6. When we get to people over 80, it's like 12. Yeah. So it's crazy. And so managing all those different medications, whether you should be on them or not is a whole nother story, but managing that. And how does, again, just one mistake, right, again, cause the fall, cause the confusion, left the stove on? There are a couple of things that are what we call kind of sentinel events. So there are things that happen that almost immediately change the way that you live, right? So when we talk about safety, we talked a little bit about that before, fires, leaving the stove on, that's pretty much a trigger. If that happens, something significant has to change in that environment. We talked a little bit about wandering, so somebody who is found, right, in their nightgown and it's, you know, 20 degrees outside, that person can't live alone anymore. So there are certain things, and in terms of, you know, medication use, what we find is that if somebody has, again, had a significant event because of a medication mistake, medication use, very often there are some things we can put into place. But if somebody has lost the cognition to be able to even know to go to the pill box and can't take their medicine, and some medicines like insulin, for example, would be really important to be able to manage. So again, this is one of those things that's extremely important.
Mm-hmm. What about medication that has to be taken at different times, if you have that all in one little compartment there? You know,
yeah.
It could be confusing for some people.
Right.
What do I take when?
Right. So there are a lot of different products, right, in terms of these medication mm-hmm. setups, right? So we have ones that are morning only, Monday through Friday. Right? I have patients that have, you know, 5 boxes. So you have 8 a.m., 10 a.m., noon,
yeah.
2, 4, 6, whatever,
yeah.
You know. There are, again, medication boxes with alarms, right? There are actually these things called Medicaps that we can download, and families can know whether or not their mom took the pills.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, technology, you know, helps some today. People will tout technology as the new panacea for staying home alone. I'm waiting to see what the evidence is on that. I think, again, it helps. So we know, for example, Lifeline is extremely helpful. And Lifeline provides a tremendous amount of you know, obviously support to people who fall, but really for children living far away, provides the security to know that if something did happen, that you could get help immediately. One of the challenges with that is what? What do you think?
You're not wearing them.
They're not wearing them. You know. Yes, it happens all the time. People are not wearing them, or people don't want to push them, which, yeah. We also have them now that they work outside the house. So there was a time where you had to be close to your telephone. Now you can, you know, be out in the garden or whatever, which, again, helps for people to achieve a certain quality of life. And again, no, if I did fall outside and I couldn't get up, that I could get some help.
Is there a GPS on it too?
So there are some that have a GPS. And again, it depends on how sophisticated people are. I mean, just with any old cell phone now, you know, any old smartphone, you can download a GPS app. So for some reason, my children didn't want me to have that app on their phone. You know, one's 40 and one's 25. So, you know, I don't know why they didn't want me to know where they were at any moment in time. But they really, you know, they were shying away from that. But there is the capability to do that for sure with the. I think, you know, just to talk for a minute about technology, I think in, you know, 5 years from now, we will have technology that's really inexpensive that can actually help to support people at home. I think right now we're not there yet. You can actually install cameras that are very inexpensive now. So that's one mechanism that you can do. I think some of this, you know, I scratch my head literally. I worry about privacy, right? So do you really want cameras all over your house for your kid to go on their computer in, you know, Arkansas and be seeing what you're doing? You know. But again, that's certainly an option, and that can be done, you know, relatively inexpensively. There are monitors that actually assess someone's gait speed. So how fast somebody walks is an absolute measure of a problem if their gait speed changes. So if somebody slows down and their gait speed is reduced, that is a trigger that something's happening or something's going on. So again, you have these sensors in the ceiling that monitor your gait speed, and when it consistently over a period of time is reduced, it could potentially send an alert to somebody that something's not right. There was this one company, and you can imagine people come and try to, you know, sell things all the time to us, that the technology was for the refrigerator door. So you could monitor how many times somebody opened their refrigerator. Yeah. Yeah, I'm like, okay. Look at that. Mom's having ice cream at 2 in the morning. Yeah. And again, there's a variety of technologies that people can wear, certainly in terms of, you know, monitoring their vital signs and monitoring their weights and, you know, a whole host of things. I think at some point in the future, there probably will be some tools that we will use for older adults. There are, and I don't know if you've seen, they have even smart houses, which are kind of these... I don't know, has anybody seen these like pop-up, they're called pop-up nursing home rooms? So there's these things, they're actually very cool, that you can put in your driveway. It's like a camper, but it's like a prefab, right? Mm-hmm. So somebody can deliver a nursing home room, right, to somebody's driveway. Right? So a child, I think it's, I don't know, let's say it's, I don't know, $35,000 or something like that. But when you think about nursing home costs, like if you have funds to pay for a nursing home, those funds are eaten away pretty quickly at $10,000 a month. So there's these pop-up of like a nursing home. Now, obviously, you need the help to care for somebody. But again, I think that, you know, there is a lot of opportunities, I should say, business opportunities. When we think about the population and when we think about baby boomers, I think that there are some entrepreneurs a lot of entrepreneurs thinking about that, and what are some of the things that could be done. And technology is just one part of that as well. I'm going to stop and, again, ask for questions. And if there's anything that folks wanted to have some more information on or talk a little bit more about.
If you could supply that checklist that we can hand people to go through their homes.
Absolutely.
Would be very helpful.
Absolutely.
Where is the Lifeline office?
Where is the Lifeline office?
It's off campus someplace.
Yeah. It's on, I think it's at La Bombard. Do you know where that is? Yeah. I don't know that they have an office to go into. Have you been there?
No, but I stopped at the one in the mall. She looked about 17 years old. She knew nothing. She handed me an envelope. That didn't do me much help.
Right. So
I wanted to be able to talk with someone.
Yeah. So the person who runs that program is amazing. She's absolutely fabulous. And I believe, but I will check with her and I can get back to you, that she will actually come out to somebody's home. Right? So in order to have a Lifeline installed, obviously you have to have somebody come out. But I believe that she will actually come out to your home or meet with you someplace else that's easy for you to get to. And I don't know if most people are aware of this, but our Lifeline is on a sliding scale, ability to pay. Her name is Tammy Musty. And she uses just a, it's not, you don't even have to, you know, submit your taxes or anything. She just asks you, you know, what your income is, what, and it's kind of an honor system that she expects people to be truthful about their income, and then it can reduce the cost, which I believe is about $40 a month.
I'd like to go back to something you mentioned earlier about the difference in the support between Vermont and New Hampshire. When we moved here 10 years ago, we picked New Hampshire because of the tax structure, mm-hmm. frankly, was a driving force. However, with one child that we have who lives in Vermont, Western Vermont, it behooves us perhaps to be in Vermont. Has the tax advantage, in your judgment and your knowledge, been outweighed by this social support advantage that you see between the states?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question, and I think it depends. So it depends on, again, your personal wealth, right? So that both states deal with wealth differently. So that is certainly one consideration. Certainly, you know, the tax structure in terms of income tax in New Hampshire is a huge benefit. And what you will find is many people who work live in New Hampshire because of that, right. of that advantage. I would be hard-pressed to say, so let me, a couple of disclosures. I live in Vermont. I think that Vermont has moved forward in a different way than New Hampshire in Vermont, from a state perspective, developed a blueprint. So they developed a blueprint and they said, we are going to support our citizens as they age. And they've done that with a program called SASH. And again, the program started in the Housing Authority up in Burlington. And the idea that they would provide support services, RN, community health workers, care coordinators who actually were in the senior housing complex all the time to help seniors. So some of them needed 2 hours, as I said before, if you just needed somebody to come in and help you in the morning, maybe somebody to tuck you in at night. It was a program that they actually did, that they, the best part of it is that they measured a lot of the outcomes. So they actually demonstrated the effectiveness of this program and that for just a small amount of cost, it actually really helped to reduce transfers to the ED and the hospital. Highly successful. The woman who developed it, named Nancy Elliott, she has actually moved to Washington, and she is running the National Housing Authority in Washington, which is amazing. This model is being moved out across the country. And to her good credit, in part, it not only collected data from everybody and collected data over time, but what she did was, and she was able to do this because it's such a small state, is she was able to have people authorize the communication of healthcare providers and these SASH workers. So they could electronically communicate, so the SASH workers could get into somebody's medical record and vice versa. So there was this open communication between what was happening at the housing authority and the primary care teams. So that was really essential that they could communicate. And that is something that's really, really hard to do in some of these bigger networks, but she could do it because it was Burlington, Vermont. They then said, okay, well, what about people living in rural Vermont? And so they set out to, throughout the state of Vermont, to have these SASH workers, SASH care coordinators, that the state actually paid to put them into primary care practices. This was all done initially through a huge federal grant, and they still do have some of that funding, but it's actually now been voted on and supported by the legislature in terms of the taxes, obviously, that people pay in Vermont. Is it a perfect system? No. What we do know in the rural areas, again, it's much, much harder. So, for example, I have a patient in Windsor that it works great. It's a great SASH worker, great SASH coordinator. Then I have somebody else who lives north, you know, in Chelsea, and it doesn't work as well because there's not really a SASH coordinator that's there. New Hampshire, on the other hand, are forever threatened. Their service link is forever threatened by the legislature in terms of cutting it. Cutbacks. So I think we are faced with that. New Hampshire hasn't taken that approach of say, you know, we're going to be responsible for our citizens in that way. But I think Service Link is amazing. I think locally our Service Link and what's been done out of the local senior center, certainly in Grafton County, is pretty impressive. So I think I, at this point, standing up here, can't honestly say to you, oh, go to Vermont. It's going to be so much better. Now, you obviously can hear that I'm a New Yorker. Now, if you really want care, that's where you should go. But be careful about paying taxes. But again, it's states that have income tax that can do some of these versus states that don't really have a lot of funding.
I can't resist the opportunity to remind people that these are political decisions that get made. We have a great opportunity in November 8th to determine who is our governor and what the programs are that each of the candidates are proposing. Our state representatives, our state house and our state senates, both Vermont and New Hampshire, the wonderful thing is that they do respond to their constituents. So look at the programs that your candidates are proposing and choose wisely. If you want more services, go to one of these candidates' forums and see if you get any response, but certainly vote your wishes.
I couldn't say it better. I think you are absolutely 100% correct. I think getting involved and knowing what the candidates' views are and their history of supporting services for older adults is critical. And it's easy to find this out and asking questions, going to the forums. You can call the offices, you can ask the aides. All the candidates have aides that can provide that information to you. How did they vote on this? Can you tell me about how they have supported services for older adults? If the phone goes dead and they don't, I would say move on. But again, as we see the demographics change dramatically in this country, elections will be won or lost based on the services and the care and what people are thinking about in terms of older adults in this country. Well, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
I am going to pull up that risk assessment for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.